அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களது காலை வணக்கங்கள். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதாரவிந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்றைய சாப்டர் இட்டர்னல் அண்ட் இண்டிவிஜுவல். I am inviting Mr. Gary to start the talk.
Good morning. Today we're on Book 2, Part 1, Chapter 3, Eternal in the Individual. I thought of trying to do the whole chapter in one sitting, which is more material than we have done before, but we'll see. It depends on your questions. I'm more interested in the questions and interactions than finishing the chapter. So it's up to you to decide. For both those of you who are here in Mambalam and in the other centers, questions and interaction are more important. So please, you need not wait till the end of the session, but I will. Even if we go up till 1 o'clock, we will take time after 1 for any questions that are there. In the last chapter, Brahman, Purusha, Ishwara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti, Sri Aurobindo explained the ultimate nature of the divine consciousness and the power of that nature, which has created and become the universe. But it still leaves a fundamental question unanswered, actually, a number of questions unanswered, but we can be sure he won't neglect any of them. He asks questions that we never think of. But one very important question is unanswered, and that is about the destiny of the individual. The name of this book is not spiritual liberation or moksha or journey to the highest spiritual heavens. The name of this book is Life Divine. Life Divine. We may believe that the spirit is real, that there's a divine consciousness up there that we can aspire to and maybe even reach. But that's not his goal. The goal, he says, is we must make this divine. Where all the confusion is, all the ignorance is, all the quarrels are, all the tensions are, all the problems are, of all description, this must become divine. Is it really possible? How is it possible? And that's the fundamental issue he's going to address in this chapter. Okay, we are convinced divine is real. Okay, no argument. It's hard to argue with Sri Aurobindo. He doesn't leave us any scope. Life is created by that divine. Okay, but can this become that? That's the question. Appa has recently been reading some books by the Tamil author Devan, who wrote in the 40s, and then became an editor of Mahadevan, known as Devan. I heard about him 40 years ago from Appa because he wrote these stories about Inspector Sambhu. That's the only thing I knew about Devan for a long time. But recently he's been looking at some of the other stories and finding that this man really had an a high inspiration or an insight. And on further investigation, we don't have the facts yet, but it may have been even a direct inspiration from Sri Aurobindo because of some of the things he depicts in his stories. That's not verified, but it looks like that may be true. In one of his stories called Gomari's Lover, it's a kind of a comedy. We'd call it a farce almost. It's full of such ridiculous, absurd coincidences and happenings. But if you go to the core of the story, it's the story about a zamindar's son, Rajagopal, Rajaraman, right? Not Rajaraman, Rajagopal. He takes the name Rajaram, so that's where the confusion comes. But anyway, Rangarajan. I think it's Rangarajan. Pretty sure it's him. Anyway, he quarrels with his brother over some small thing. His older brother is saying, you're not doing anything with your life, you're wasting your time. And the boy gets angry or self-righteous, and he picks up from their home somewhere in Tanjore district and decides to go to Madras. He almost runs away from Madras. A young boy, maybe he's 21 or so. And the story, I'm not going to spoil it, it's a wonderful series of coincidences and acts. But the story is he loses his identity. He pretends to be a car driver. Somebody steals his identity and masquerades as him. And he meets a girl named Gomari, falls totally in love with her from the first minute he sees her. And at the end of a long intrigue, which seems like it takes forever, but actually is completed in 6 days, he and Gomari are blessed by their parents, who turn out to be somewhat of enemies. They're fighting a big court case in Madurai over a property. Her father's also a zamindar, a huge property they're quarreling over. Finally, her father wins the case, and when they all come to Madras to get their children, they find out the children have met her in love. And so obviously the property will go to both of them. It's the dowry, it's her dowry to him. The interesting thing, very interesting thing about this story is, if you think of and compare it with Pride and Prejudice, Pride and Prejudice goes through a similar, somewhat miraculous chain of events over a period of 1 year, and ultimately arrives at a similar happy ending to this story. One of Appa's themes has been that what happened in a year could have happened in a month or could have happened in a week if at the beginning Elizabeth had taken different attitudes than they had. He took a year to transform himself. He took a year to give up his arrogance, his self-importance, his selfishness. She took a year to give up her false attachment to Wickham and her prejudice against him. But it's not essential that it took a year. We admire him that he did it so quickly. We admire them that they did it so quickly. But supposing he had come here to the center on the first day and fully expressed himself, we could have confidently said, you can definitely marry the girl. What is it? You can live happily ever after. She says, I'm the last man on earth she would ever marry. Today she's the last, you're the last man. Tomorrow you can be the first man. Oh no, it all sounds impossible. When she has made up her mind, I don't think she'll ever change her mind. And he, So in 1 week, so that's the theme of the talk. That's our theme. In 1 week, what happened in a year can happen in a week. Appa's been talking about this for a long time. He's been asking us to try to imagine how the story would have been different if Darcy and Lizzie had been devotees and they had decided from day one to rise to the occasion. Well, now he found a story in which the whole thing happens in 6 days. So in that sense, it shows, as your live, real life example shows, it need not take time. The term is determined by us, by our willingness to change. This is a central theme for this chapter. In order to answer the question, can life become divine, which incidentally doesn't mean that life, it means this life and that life and this life, it means our lives. Can our lives become divine? We have to understand what the individual really is, who the individual really is. If the individual is really just the ignorant, selfish ego that we're quite familiar with, life can never become divine. You can't make gold out of clay. If the clay happens to contain some gold ore, you can refine the clay, sift it and purify it, and take the gold ore out of the clay, and you'll have gold. But unless the gold is in there in the first place, clay doesn't become gold. Unless the divine is in here in the first place somewhere, this clay is not going to become divine. We can be quite clear about it. It's logical. But tradition treats this ego as ignorant, false, all of which is very true, selfish, filled with desire, mortal, weak. All these things sound much more like clay than they do like gold. How is this thing ever going to become divine? Not only that, but he says a divine life is not just a divine life for each of us. Life will be divine. Mother's atmosphere of grace will be everywhere. Everything will be divine. Our relations with everybody will be divine. So it's not enough that you discover some gold nuggets hidden in the clay here. There has to be gold nuggets everywhere. There has to be something about the world around us in which we live that certainly is not an illusion, as Shankara said. If it's an illusion, there's no question of it. The only thing we can do is wake up from the bad dream and find out that life didn't really exist. Or if it's evil, or if it's a round of suffering and death and cycles of death and suffering, as Buddha said, certainly there's no question of this life becoming divine. Unless the world is also made of gold nuggets that we don't see because we see only the clay around, there's no hope of a divine life. And if the individual is really separate from the world, if we really are each some isolated thing, unrelated or unconnected essentially with the world around us, how are we going to make that divine? Or how is that going to make us divine? And if we as individuals and as world are totally separate from and unconnected to the divine itself, which is normally, I think, how we feel. If we feel there's a divine, if we're aware of a divine at all, it's up there. Mother, 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 please come. Mother, come, don't desert me, don't forget me. Remember, I'm here, I need your help. As if she's thousands or millions of miles away, or maybe sometimes we feel she's only a few feet away, but she's away. She's separate. She's something other than we are. If the individual is separate from the divine, how is it going to become the divine? So these three issues, what is the nature of the individual, what is the nature of the world, and what is the nature of the world and the individual to the divine, is central to a divine life. Not necessary if you're after moksha. After all, you want to give up your individuality, you want to give up the world, and you want to go back to the highest heavens of peace and quiet and rest. So we need not worry about what it is. We want to wake up from the bad dream. You don't care whether the dream is real or not or what it's made of. Let's get out of it. Let's wake up to spiritual reality. He says, no, the goal is the dream must become divine. The nightmare must be turned into an eternal romance. For that, it must have some reality to it that's capable of being divinized. He says the problem with answering this question is twofold. One is our minds, our logic. We're so confused about the nature of reality because of the way our minds think about reality. As I said, when we think of Mother, we think of her as separate from ourselves. When we think of the divine, divine is something else and somewhere else. Why that? Even the world. Oh, this life. I can't stand this life anymore. All these other people. This is not right. We talk about it. We don't say all my other selves. We don't say the rest of me. We feel that separation, and our language encourages it. And when we talk about the individual, because English and most languages don't have an alternative, by the individual, what do we mean? We mean that which is separate from everything else. Our very language encourages us. When we say that man or that woman, we mean somebody separate from everybody else. So our very language is encouraging this. Not only that, but our spiritual experiences encourage it too. Because for a long time, when we have spiritual experiences, we have one experience. Maybe for a minute we feel in a real touch of Mother. But we feel Mother coming to us as if she's separate. Maybe if we're lucky for a moment we feel something divine inside. But that doesn't automatically grant the same status to everybody else. So our experiences, because they're limited, because they're divided and partial, they tend to encourage this same idea. And when we look at the human intelligence, the egoistic human intelligence, Sri Aurobindo has wonderful things to tell us about it, about all the virtues of our intelligence. First of all, he says, we take appearances for facts. Like Lizzie saying, this man is so handsome, he must be good. Wonderful example of what we do all the time. We are easily misled by partial truths, by parts of the truth. Mr. Bennett or Mr. Gardner argues that Lydia is too poor for any man to bother about her. So this story about elopement couldn't be true. Lydia is too poor, but the elopement is also true. We tend to exaggerate conditions. Mrs. Bennett is fantasizing that Charlotte and Colin spend all of their time dreaming about taking over Longbourn, and they're counting all the furniture and the silverware as if they have nothing else to do. Our minds, that's very real to the imagination. He says, at best we make a bungling effort to link things together, to construct some truth like we're lawyers in a court case or inspectors in a police case trying to piece together the evidence to prove a point. In one of Davin's other novels, which the only one translated into English so I could read it, it's called Justice Jagannathan. It's also a wonderful story about a murder trial. The first half of the book is the prosecutor's case. He presents all the evidence to show that the man is guilty. Bharadarajan is guilty. And everybody's convinced in the whole court, the jury, everybody is convinced, even the reader is convinced. Evidence is so strong. The second half of the book, the defense attorney presents all the evidence against it. And he shows for each evidence showing the man is guilty, says another fact that shows he may be innocent or somebody else is guilty. So the author had a wonderful perception of the problems we have with our mind. We can argue any case convincingly. And if we're hired by the other side, we can argue the opposite case convincingly true, because that's the nature of our mind. Then how are we going to resolve this issue about a divine life? We can't do it with the arguments of our rational mind. He says the first difficulty we have to overcome is the idea that I am the ego, that our individuality is the same as the ego, because that's the way we feel, and that's the way we talk. And when we interact with other people, we talk the same way also. We think of ourselves as our true self is the limited ego. If you ask me, if you're a stranger and you ask me who I am, I'd say I'm an American from California who I came to India 40 years ago. I live in this place. I studied this thing. I do this work. This is my marriage and my family. These are my friends. That's my car, or this is my shirt, or whatever it is. What am I describing? What is my sense of myself? When Darcy sees Lizzie at the dance, what does he really see? He sees a girl in a Meriden, not a very prestigious place. She's not wearing a fancy gown that would be there in London. She's sitting while other ladies are dancing, means somebody has decided she's a less desirable partner. So instinctively he says, this girl, because she's sitting down, is less desirable than the other girls. I'm not going to dance with her. And without even really, he doesn't know anything about her. He knows only the most superficial appearance, just the way Lizzie knows only the most superficial appearance of Wickham and never understands the man at all. Do we know ourselves any better? Are we any better even with relation to ourselves? If you have to write and say who you are, you will also end up saying, this is my education, these were my parents, this is where I live, this is my husband or my wife and my children. And we define ourselves. It's just like saying, I am the man who's wearing this shirt and these pants today. It sounds a little silly, no? Then tomorrow I'm a different man because I changed my shirt. But that's what we do. We don't know who we are. And certainly it's not my shirt and my pants that are going to become divine. And it's not my job or my education or my house or my car or how much money I have in the bank that's going to determine whether I can become the divine or not. It's not those things. The car is not to become divine. I am supposed to become divine. Who? It's not my shirt. Who is it that's to become divine? What is my real self? That's the question that has to be answered if we're going to talk about a divine life. The self we're talking about, the ego we're talking about, we know is not going to be here tomorrow. Not going to be here in 10 years or 50 years, depending on our age. That can't be the thing that's going to be divine. The body's getting old. It's not this body that's going to be divine. Hopefully, my personality will be changing and it won't be the same tomorrow as it is today. It's not something we can count on to be divine and to be eternal. We're talking, when he talks about divine life, he's talking about immortality. He's talking about immortality even in a physical form. It's not this thing that's going to be immortal. I hope it's not this personality or these thoughts and this confused mind and these emotions that are going to be immortal. It's got to be something much more important and central than that. So it raises, who am I? What is our real individuality? And he says it's obviously not the surface personality that when I say, I believe this, or I feel this, or I want this, or I did this, it's none of those things. This is not the one we're talking about. The I that we think of ourselves is not our real individuality. Our individuality is something behind that, which is conscious in us. And is having all of these experiences, identifying with these thoughts, with this body, with these feelings, with these attitudes, opinions, and I say I'm doing these acts. The way I think of it is, if you go to a movie, old movie theater, I don't know how they do it now, where there's a movie projector and a light projecting, and the film is shown on the screen, we're watching the movie. But the light that makes the movie real is from the projector. It's a consciousness of the projector that gives life to the film. We're watching our own movie, our own lives is the movie we're watching, whereas the life in us is the projector, is the light, is the consciousness, is the purusha, is the conscious being that's allowing, identifying itself with these experiences. And we have to get back from the movie to the person who's conscious. We know for sure that Jane Austen is not Elizabeth and Mrs. Bennet and Lady Catherine or any of the action in the story. She's behind. She's the consciousness that's created all of this. Well, like that, we have a consciousness behind, whether we call it the purusha or the psychic, and it's that must be the source of our true individuality. And we know that Jane Austen, when she creates a story, she thinks through and chooses how to fashion each character, how to fashion each event. She creates Elizabeth Bennet because she has this idea of a cheerful, courageous girl. She creates Mr. Collins because she has this idea of a very silly, sycophant man. Maybe she has seen somebody like that. She creates a Lady Catherine out of her experiences or her imagination or her ideas. She imagines the most handsome man she can think of and creates a Wickham. But those, none of those things are her. She's the thing that creates that. None of the things we are, the things we think, the things we feel, the things we say, the things we do, certainly not the things we wear or buy or own, none of that is us. They're all the things created or chosen by the I in us for a temporary purpose, for a story. The story of this life. And this life is not to become divine. It's not this particular thing. It's that that is essentially divine and should show itself. But we are not just a conscious being. Our lives are also composed of material from the world around us. We may be conscious beings, deep inside. But we have fashioned a personality for ourselves, a life for ourselves, just the way Jane Austen has fashioned stories and characters from her experience. Oh, when I was young, I met a man like that, so she creates a character. One time I had an experience like that, so she creates an event. Any of you who have ever tried writing a story know you end up thinking about your own experience, the people you know, the things you've done and felt, and you disguise them and change them. You draw from the material of the world around you. So our lives, what we call our life, consists of two things: the projector, the light of the projector, and the film. The film is the raw material we've gathered from the world around us. We don't have any identity other than the world. If I asked you to tell me something about you individually that does not relate to anything in the world around you, you can't say anything. No, I was born, not where, don't tell me where. No, not your father. No, my children, don't talk about anybody else, talk about yourself. My education, no, that's all external, that's all social. What about you? I don't know who I am. All I know are the things in the movie that I have identified with, and I say, this is me. I'm like Lizzie, I'm not like Lydia. Or I'm like Darcy, I'm not like Wickham. Or something like that. It's all something we have fashioned by putting together the conscious individual light inside us and some of the material from the world around us. So our identity is the two of these, the individual and the world, and we don't exist independent of that. But then what is our true individuality? When our true individuality emerges, we find we are no longer identified solely with the person sitting in our place. I'm here and you're there. I'm me and you're you. When we universalize ourselves, when we discover that part of us is in everybody else, the real you, the real me, is not located in one place only. The real you and the real me lives in everybody. And we feel that oneness and relation to everybody the way Rangarajan feels the first time he sees Gomari and loses himself completely, loses his suitcase, loses his identity, loses everything, only to get it back. The way Darcy feels when he falls in love with Lizzie and says, I really can't live without you. What he does or they do with one person, in a divine life, we will do with everybody. Because we say, I can't live without you, literally because you're part of me. Not because I need you, because you are part of me. So in spiritual experiences, the first step to a divine life is we have to find out we are not really this separate ego, unconnected with the world, unconnected with everybody else. We are at some level one with the world around us. So he says the first step in progress is we must move from the ego, which is separate and divided, to the psychic inside. The psychic inside, our soul, which is awake and knows it's one, feels that oneness with everybody, feels that relationship. That's the real source of love. If there's anything higher in Darcy's love for Elizabeth, it's because in the depths of his soul, he feels a soulmate there, as Rangarajan and Gomari feel for each other, with one person. When you go deeper into the psychic, you realize it's not with one person only. It's there with everybody because we are not separate from everybody else. We are not cut off and divided from everybody else. That's only the illusion of the ego. There is a oneness with the whole world around us. And when we think about it, that's not so surprising. Last time I mentioned to you, if you think about what we have that we call our own or who we are, everything has come from the world around us. We probably don't have anything that really we can claim as our own. The language I use is a language given to us by the society. The ideas I have, the thoughts I have, the values I have, the customs I have, the way we behave, our manners, our behaviors, everything we have. The technology we're using, of course, that's obvious. We haven't invented any of that ourselves. You saying, is the answer went to who am I? I'm humankind. Good question. In his book, The Mother, Sri Aurobindo describes humankind. He describes it in terms of 27 characteristics of the physical, vital, and mental. He says, this is human nature. I think we can all familiar with these things. Doubt, disbelief, confusion, desire, jealousy, competition, laziness. He's got a long, long list. We need not go to the end. All of those things are us. Because we are human. But that's not... That is the material that we have taken by taking birth in a human body and being human. But if life is to become divine, all those 27 characteristics have to be transformed. That is the work. Darcy coming from pride and arrogance to humility, from selfishness to selflessness. So that's obviously not where we want to be. That may be very rightly where we are today. We are human. We are human nature. And it's not, and we are universal in that sense. We're universal in having all the bad habits of everyone else. We're not universal in knowing the soul of everybody else or even our own soul. He's asking us to reject and transform those 27. Reject them means, as long as I feel justified in my selfishness and my self-importance, I can't transform it. The first thing I have to do is stop believing that that's me. Right now, the problem is, whatever I think, whatever I feel, whatever I sense, I feel that's true. That's right. It's right that everybody treats me as important. It's right that I look down like Darcy at everybody as inferior or whatever it is. It's right that everybody gives me things and doesn't expect me to give anything in return. That's human nature. Obviously, unless I can see that human nature. Darcy sees that human nature after she abuses him. He sees, oh, I thought I was, he was very proud of himself. Suddenly he sees he's been selfish. He's been mean. He's been arrogant. He's been proud. He feels ashamed of it. He rejects it. He rejects it means what's left. He has to transform it into its opposite. He has to transform the meanness, selfishness, pride, and arrogance into humility, self-giving, goodness, goodwill, generosity. Lizzie, when she reads his letter, she recognizes, I've been acting absurdly. I never knew myself till now. 2 minutes earlier, she was very self-righteous. I am right and he's wrong. Then she said, she realized something in her has to change. Mr. Bennett realized that. So when we say rejection, what we mean, what he means is, We have to stop justifying the dark ignorance in order that we can separate and realize this is not me. As long as I believe that this is me, how can I change it? I have to detach from it. I want to divinize it. I want to change the shirt. The shirt I've got on has got full of spots and dirt, and I first have to take it off and replace it with something better. The attitudes, the thoughts, the values and everything are like the shirt. It's me inside that's going to change it, transform it. We are going to transform and decide instead of expressing the low things, we're going to express the high things. It turns out that when we do that, each time we do that, we not only change, the thing, life changes. Life becomes better. Life around us becomes better because we are changing not just for ourselves, because we are one with the world, we're changing for everybody. That was why what Mother was doing. That's what she is doing even now through us. If all the devotees possible, if all the devotees become truthful and good and generous, the world will be different. Human nature will be different because we are connected with everything else. Clear? Good question. Good question. If we're just going to reject, then you're in the old sadhana of reject everything, not just the bad things. You should reject the good things also, because everything is to be given up so you can go to moksha. No sense hanging on to your sense of virtue or your sense of goodness. That's also bad baggage for you. We want to transform everything into the higher. So the first step is we have to universalize ourselves, meaning the ego. We have to realize we are not the ego. We're not the clothes, we're not all the things we feel, all the arguments we give, all the impulses, all the urges, all the self-justifications that we have. There's something true in us inside, and when we reach that, the psychic, we also find there's something true in everybody else too, and in fact, it's not disconnected from us. It's one in essence with what we are. So the soul universalizes itself, and it's the first step in the integral yoga, and it's the first step towards a life divine. And if there is nothing in us which is connected with everybody else, we can never have union or oneness with the world around us. Ashok asked a very good question last week. He said, if we're supposed to overcome the ego or reject the ego, who's going to do that? If I'm the ego and you ask me to give up the ego, who is the I that's going to give up the ego? Isn't it also the ego? And if the ego is claiming that it's giving up the ego, it's probably fooling all of us. There's a nice story, I don't know where I heard it long ago, about Jay Krishnamurti. Once he was in the U.S. and he delivered a talk to some devotees about ego. And at the end of the talk, one of the men came up, I don't know from which country or where, who he was. And he said to him, what you said is very interesting. I have given up the ego. And Krishnamurti looked very surprised. Really? You have given up the ego. Yes, I have given up the ego. Really? You have given up the ego. Really? And finally, the man, yes, I have given up the ego. Then who is it that's angry right now? Is that your soul that's angry? See, so it's a very good question Ashok asked. Because the ego, under any subterfuge, under any masquerade, will claim any virtue for itself, including giving itself up, but only getting bigger all the time, which is what Aurobindo calls spiritual ego. And our ego becomes more and more important, which happens a lot in spiritual tradition. So how do we give up the ego? Who gives up the ego? What do we mean by giving up the ego? First thing, look at the story. Lizzie reads Darcy's letter and she sees, oh, I was wrong about Darcy. I was wrong about Wickham. Wickham's really a bad man. 2 minutes ago, I was so angry at Darcy, I wanted to strangle him. I was defending Wickham so strongly. Now I see, all this time I'd behaved absurdly. The truth of the matter is, Wickham flattered me. He was talking to me, and this handsome man was talking to me instead of all the other ladies, and Lizzie felt flattered by it, and then she wanted to believe everything he said. And Darcy has called her tolerable, so she wanted to believe everything bad that Wickham said about Darcy. What happened? She said, I have been acting absurdly. Who said that? Her mind, looking down at the vital, said, my vital attitudes, my attachment, the flattery, all of that is absurd. I must move away from it. I must reject it. So she moved from the vital to the mental. We can say she moved from the vital ego towards something that was more true, more conscious. She became more conscious of herself. When Darcy proposed to her at Hunsford, he was not thinking of anything except his need. He never thought for a minute, what does Lizzie want? Does Lizzie want to marry me? He never occurred to him. He never thought about it. He was so selfish. And when she abused him and said, you're the last man on earth. You're so proud. You're so arrogant. From the first month I knew you, I decided you're the last man on earth I could ever marry. He suddenly saw himself differently. Something separated from the surface, his own image of himself. He thought he was very important. He thought he was very good. He thought he was the perfect man. Now he sees himself through her eyes, and he says, oh, I guess I'm not like that at all. This is a very bitter lesson, but it seems to be true. Something in him goes to a deeper level of sincerity. We can say he became more conscious of what the surface was. He separated himself from the surface part and went to a deeper part in him. When we talk about the ego, it's not like the ego is a thing. It's in one place at one time and you can corner it and put it in a box or throw it out the window. The ego is everywhere. Where is it? It's hiding in everything. In which things? Every thought I have. Why? Because every thought I have, I'm thinking from my point of view. Every feeling I have. Why? Because every feeling I have, I'm not thinking about what you're thinking, feeling and what you want. I'm thinking what I want. That's the ego. It's there in everything. It's there in my every impulse. So I have to become conscious of it in each strand of my personality and detach from it. Because only then, when I detach from it, I can express something other than ego. As long as that's it, as long as I think my thoughts are myself, my feelings are myself, my impulses are myself, everything I do is only an expression of my ego. So what's the method for that? You all know it. He calls it consecration. Take that urge. Right now I want to really abuse that person who's called me tolerable. Take that urge, forget the other person and the tolerable and everything. Why are you angry? Why are you disturbed? Being disturbed is only the ego. Let me separate wherever, whether I have a soul or not, where is who I am, I don't have to worry about. One thing I know is my irritation is not my soul. That I can be sure. I may not know where my soul is or what it looks like or how to get there, but I definitely know my irritation is not my soul. My anger is not my soul. Carolyn's jealousy towards Lizzie is not her soul. My sense of self-importance is definitely not my soul, because the soul feels one and equal with everybody else. So wherever I feel self-important, my sense of inferiority is not my soul, because the soul feels equal with everybody else. It doesn't feel inferior to anything. My fear definitely doesn't come from my soul, because the soul is spiritual and immortal. So what I can know at the first is all the things that are not my soul, meaning all the things that are my ego. Mother has a formula, I don't know where, I read it a long time ago, but it's something like, all that disturbs, all that's angry, all that gets depressed, all that's impatient, of course none of us are ever impatient, all that's in a hurry, all that can be disturbed or irritated in any way comes straight from the falsehood of the ego. It's a clear roadmap for us. We may not know where we're going, but we know which direction we shouldn't be going in. And she then says, all that is full of peace, cheerfulness, light, harmony, goodwill, comes from the psychic. So whether we know our psychic or not, this is like a roadmap. This is like suddenly we have street signs everywhere, which you never get in Madras. You can always know at any moment which is the right direction to go in, even if you don't know the destination. If there's a sense of self-importance, turn around and go in the other direction. If there's a sense of anger, turn around and go in the direction. If you feel an impatient need for an initiative, turn around. If you feel an urge to tell other people what they should do, be quiet, practice silent will. Better yet, consecrate to Mother. So it's kind of like, if you don't know where you're going, you can back away from where you shouldn't be going and you'll end up finally in the psychic. So there is in everything we do, coming back to Ashok's question, in everything we do, there is something that is acting. There is something that is energizing our act. It's the conscious being behind. Because we're identified with the action, I'm identified with the thought or with the feeling, and I think that's me, that's the problem. So the first thing I need to do is, no, this urge, this anger, this self-righteousness, this opinion, this urge to dominate over somebody else is not me, it's not my soul, so I'm going to detach from it, I'm going to reject it, if I can, I'm going to consecrate it. What does it mean? To consecrate it. You say, Mother, I want to tell everybody what to do. I'm not going to tell anybody what to do. I'm going to consecrate this to you. You tell everybody what to do. It's your responsibility. I don't know what everybody should do. I don't even know what I should do. Though I have opinions about what everybody else should do, truth is, I don't even know what I should be doing. Who am I to give advice to anybody else about their lives? Let me be quiet. Let me reject it. It's your will should be done, not my will. So I move away from the ego. I move more and more towards the true center of my being, which now is unconscious in me. It's buried there and behind where I can't get it. But I can certainly know the right direction to go in. And Appa's constantly talking about values because values are a roadmap for us. They're street signs for us. When Mr. Bennett says, oh, this is very nice. Mrs. Bennett feels very nice. My brother Gardner paid for Lydia's marriage. That's very good. It's very convenient for me. He could have given a bigger wedding. He could have bought her some more clothes, too. That would have even been better. That's convenient for the ego. The vital likes that when everybody gives us what we want, even if we don't deserve it. But what does Mr. Bennett do? Why should he pay for my daughter's wedding? Is it right? He has 4 or 5 children of his own. Just because he's willing to do that, does it make it right? Is it right for me to accept that? Just because I haven't saved money after 23 years of marriage, that's my problem, that's my fault. Why should he and his family suffer for that? Mrs. Gardner must be an angel that she has let him do that and not complained or prevented it. But even if she's an angel and he's an angel, what does it make me? He says, no, what is right? He consults his sense of honor. And in his society, he says, it's not right that I should allow him to do what's convenient for me. It's right that I should pay it back. Well, you can imagine that this is not the ego saying that. The ego wants something that's convenient. It wants something to justify its position, like Mrs. Bennett. He detaches from his view. He doesn't look at things from his point of view. He looks at it from the point of view of a higher value of honor. And he says, according to the value of honor, I should not accept this help from Gardner. At least I have to pay him back. So he's moving in that decision from his ego towards the spirit, towards the psychic. And what happens? He doesn't have to pay back anybody anything because it was sincere. Because he sincerely followed the roadmap of a value. Well, in every act we do, in every decision we do, we can evaluate every decision not in terms of the law, not in terms of convenience, not in terms of my capacity, but in terms of what's right according to the highest values we know. It will always point us in the right direction. It's a compass. Values are a compass. So, what is this in us that discovers that it's universal? It's the self in us. It's the self in us which gives birth in us to an individualized part of that self, which is, he calls, the spiritual individual. We've talked about it earlier. We heard about that self in the last chapter. That self is the transcendent divine. It's the divine being. It's that divine being that has entered into the cosmos in each of us and become a psych, a soul, a psychic being that's evolving. And if we want a divine life, that's the divine, not us, not my shirt, not my opinions, not my emotions, not my status. That's the divine in us. And if we want a divine life, it's not to convert this into divinity. It's to let that come out and express in my life. It's not that all my opinions should be taken for truth. It's that I should give up all my opinions so that the truth can express. It's not that all my desires should be fulfilled. It's that I should give up the ego's desires so that the divine's will can express through me. Not only for my sake, but for the sake of everybody else. So that transcendent being is the truth of my individuality. And we've heard about it in many chapters in the past, how the one has becomes the many. And that one is seated inside us, in each of us, in the depths of our heart. At one level, it's the spiritual individual or the psychic. At a deeper level, we can say it's the inner divine. We can discover the divine being. There is gold ore in this ball of clay. It's not the clay. It's we have to bring out the gold ore that's buried inside. And as we discover that, the more we discover that gold inside, the more we discover it in everyone and everything around us. The more we universalize ourselves, the more we also discover the transcendent truth of our being. And ultimately, what we are going to discover is that is divine. This is divine, and all of this is divine too. Divine not in its expression, we're all wearing these dirty clothes today. Divine in its essence. And when he says divine life, he doesn't mean that life is already divine and there's nothing we need to do, we just need to change our opinion about it. He means that the divinity that's hidden in the balls of clay will come forward and transform those balls of clay, reveal that it's all, make it all into gold. But we have to get to the truth of ourselves, the truth of other people, and the truth of the world. He says, this self, this transcendent divine that has become everything, become the universe, it has differentiated itself in the cosmos, expressing millions and millions of characteristics. Each is a potential truth of the divine being. Because the divine is infinite, it wants to express infinite variety. Why does Lizzie write a novel with 30 characters instead of one character? Because there's so many aspects of her creative consciousness she wants to express. Each one has a truth in it. Wickham is so charming. We may frown on Wickham for the elopement and all, but you'll never meet a man so charming as Wickham. He's beautiful. His behavior is beautiful. He just, everybody who sees him falls in love with him. It's a great trait. I wish it had happened to me. Can we be so nice as Wickham that everybody who meets us falls in love with us? The problem with Wickham is not that he's charming. The problem is that inside he's a rogue. But his charm is real. It's divine. We can say it's divine in itself. Darcy is a good man. Genuinely a good man inside. A little selfish, but he's a genuinely honorable man. But his behavior is atrocious, abhorrent, horrible. The way he speaks and offends people, even the way he proposes, is unpardonable. But that doesn't mean that there isn't that spark of truth in him and goodness in him. Each of us has that hidden or on the surface, some quality that's a spark of the divine that wants to grow and emerge and manifest itself so that all these qualities can be on the surface. Question. Okay. Thank you for telling. Ashok, how come I don't see questions? How do we know that? Yes, Ashok, please ask.
You hear me now?
Yes, very clearly.
See, what you are saying about PNP regarding Darcy and Lissy is contrary to my experience. So far, I have known only men who have ruined their lives by listening to the advice of a woman. Here you are saying a man changed his life for the better by receiving the scolding of a woman. This is not consistent with my experience. Even when the advice of a woman can only ruin a man's life, how on earth the scolding of a woman can lead to its improvement?
Great question. Great question.
Unless there is something exceptional in the woman, it's not possible that her scolding caused a miracle in the man's life. See, 9 out of 10 cases, if I go and tell Appa, you see this lady said this, that lady said this. His immediate reaction is, don't come and tell me that this lady or that lady said this and that. What is your personal opinion? That alone you speak. Don't quote any lady to me. This being my actual experience, you say somebody giving out a harsh scolding to a man for full 10 minutes reformed his life and made him two gentlemen. So unless the lady is somewhat exceptional, this is not possible.
I didn't say that everything that anyone says is true. If you believe that everything that everyone says, especially every lady around you says, then anybody's going to get in trouble, not just you. Remove the issue of man and wife here, which adds a little color to the conversation. and give you a more easily understood example that will remove the confusion. What Wickham speaks about Darcy is absolutely false.
Wow.
I think everybody knows that, but it's also true. The facts are absolutely false, but the truth is that Darcy deserves to be scandalized because his behavior is scandalous. So, for Darcy, I'm removing man and wife for the moment now, so you get that one. For Darcy, what should Darcy do if he's a devotee and he finds out that Wickham is scandalizing him like this? He should say, why does this scandal come to me? Why is this man abusing me, and why are people believing him? There must be something in me that deserves abuse. Otherwise, it won't be coming to me. This is the beauty and genius of her story, that a false scandal serves a true purpose. It helps him become a better, because Lizzie gets so angry with Darcy because she believes the falsehood. The falsehood won't help Darcy change, but there's a truth in that falsehood. The truth is you're proud and arrogant and selfish and mean and pompously self-important, and somebody should knock down and remove that. So Darcy has the goodness and sincerity. Say, any man in Darcy's position, when he hears Lizzie's response, he'll feel very self-righteous. You foolish girl, you have believed that man's lies about me just because he's handsome. He's told you a complete story. You idiot, I can prove he's wrong. You're just a fool. I'm glad that I know that I shouldn't marry a girl like you. At least you should apologize to me. He doesn't say that. He doesn't accuse her. How can you be so foolish? How can you speak what's wrong? He asks himself why she says I'm the last man on earth. Yes, I have been behaving. I can't believe it myself. When I think back, I never thought about her happiness. I never thought about anything. I've been selfish. He says, I've been selfish all my life. He has the sincerity to discover the truth, even in the falsehood that comes. So, it's not a question that everything the wife says is true, or everything the wife or the husband, for that matter. You can turn it around. You happen to be a husband, and so your version of it is the wife. It's not true that everything that anybody says is all true or all false. The problem is, if we believe all that the falsehood that people speak to us is true, and we refuse to accept all the truth in what they say because it's not convenient for us, then we get the worst of both worlds. So, when you quote other people on things that only complicate the problem because you believe, or you or anybody, you made it personal, I'm trying to make it impersonal. When anybody quotes everybody else's opinions on things which only add to the confusion and the falsehood, it's better to say, let's not complicate things. You forget what everybody else told you. What do you know is true? I can deal, if you and I are discussing, I can deal with you and your convictions, but if I have to deal with everybody else you're quoting who has told you something, it becomes impossible. You can only deal rationally with one person according to what they know. You can't deal with people who are not there, who have said this and said that for their own reasons. I'm sure I have not satisfied you, but...
To some extent.
Right now, I'm quite content for a pass mark. I will move on.
Sorry.
Thanks for that. Great question. So what's the purpose of this? The purpose is the divine has differentiated itself in the cosmos and created multiple individualities. I read somewhere recently that there are 200,000 different varieties of flowers in the world. 200,000. Another says each flower has its own consciousness, its quality of consciousness. So there are 7 billion people in the world. So each of us has a different formula of divine truth. Not that what's expressing in my behavior, but what's there in my soul, which wants to come out, which will come out when life is divinized. And maybe we'll have 7 billion types of flowers by then, each with a different divine quality. And each mixing together. You know, Mother used to mix the flowers together in bouquets. So she didn't just give roses or gladiola or new creation or life energy. She would give them in a mix. Each mix had a message to it. So imagine if you take 200,000 flowers and you mix them in different combinations. Any mathematician in the room will go, it's an impossibly large number. We can't imagine. So many divine potentials are there. The 7 billion of us mixing together. So you see in the Bennett family, Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Bennett, only two personalities. They mix together. They have children. They have 5 children. What a difference between them. Between Leah on one end and Jane and Lizzie on the other end. Just by mixing two things together. Of course, they're not two things. Each of them is 100 things. And you mix it and you can, if they had 100 children, they would all be different like that. So this is the purpose of individuality in the world, to allow multiple individuality, a cosmic differentiation of all the millions of potential true qualities of the divine that will come together, not to quarrel and fight and compete with each other the way they do now, in a harmony. He calls it a harmonic unity. Not the noise that we hear all around us on the city streets, but a magnificent symphony. A beautiful harmonious sound. That is the destiny. So the individual here, what about the individual? What is this, all this thing we heard about moksha and go back to the oneness and all? He says the oneness is true. We can, each of us, have the experience of oneness with the divine. What does it mean to be one with the divine? It means to know you are the divine. Oneness doesn't mean that you join together. Oneness is not marriage. Oneness is to discover that in your inmost being, you are the divine. And he calls that the undifferentiated unity. It's the unity you have because everything's the same. That's the depth, that's the truth of our being. And that's what happens when you go to moksha. You go and merge back to that undifferentiated unity. But he says, there's another type of unity that the soul can have. We can have the differentiated unity, active unity with every other expression and form of the divine, with every other soul or psychic, and know that is also divine and feel our oneness with that. We don't have to sit in the library like Mr. Bennett and only enjoy our reading in quiet and peace. We can have the same joy moving around in the world and interacting with millions of people, and each one will be a unique experience. So those who seek moksha want to spend the eternity in the library. Sri Aurobindo says the divine created a universe because it's for you. It's your playground. It's your field for adventure. You can go anywhere. You can do anything. But what about that? What about that undifferentiated unity, that oneness? You can have it all the time. You don't have to choose. It's not like you have to choose either to be in the library or to be out at the dance. You can have oneness in your soul all the time, even when you're at Netherfield Hall. Even when you're with Lady Catherine and Rosings, wherever you go, you can have the joy and peace and quiet of knowing you are the one. You can also have the joy, the delight of seeing the divine in others and relating to the divine in its various expressions. And he says this is why the divine created the universe. Not it created this big mess so that it can escape from it and go back to the library again. It created it because it wants an infinite adventure of joy and consciousness in the universe. So the mistake the mind makes is thinking we can only have oneness by giving up the multiplicity. That's the mistake we make. We have to choose. We don't have to choose. The multiplicity is an expression of the one. And we can have both simultaneously because not only the one is our inmost nature, but the one can be our outer nature and expression. The world can be divinized, and each individual can be divinized also. So it's a new message to the world. It's the first, he's the first to come and say, the goal is not to get out of the nightmare and wake up. The goal is to convert the nightmare into romance eternal and enjoy every relationship without giving up anything. We don't give up the greatest, highest spiritual experience. Rather, the greatest spiritual experience is not in the library. It's to have the peace and joy and oneness of the library wherever you are in whatever you do. That is the destiny of the individual. And he says, he also talks about what do we mean by this oneness with others? The problem is with the language. We can't imagine what oneness with others is. It just doesn't make sense. Either we are separate or we're one. Does it mean we have one body? Does it mean we physically are one thing? What does it mean? He says, say now we each know what it is to be one with ourselves. In the sense, I know who I am, I'm here. At least I know, I identify with what's going on here. All of you are strangers to me in the sense I can look at you. I can try to guess what you're thinking or feeling from the expressions on your face. But my feelings are real to me. Yours I can only infer. If I know you really well, I can sympathize. Oh, I know what you're thinking now, or I know what you're feeling now. That's what the husband and wife can do. We can anticipate. But I can't be you. But imagine if each of you could be everyone else. Not by losing yourself. Not in the same way we are ourselves. But if I could feel and take the same joy in your joy that I take in my own. Feel the love you feel, the goodness you feel, the goodwill you feel, the peace you feel, he says that's what to universalize means. Not that we give up our individual moment. We still have our individual center. There's still a difference because the divine is looking out at the world from inside me, from inside each of you. But it can also know itself in everybody else. And that's the experience of cosmic consciousness. It's not that we lose ourselves. We still know the divine is in us, but we become the conscious of the divine in everyone else as well, and in the world, and in everything that's happening. And Sri Aurobindo had that experience in Alipur jail. The jailer was the divine, Krishna for him. The tree was Krishna, the judge. And the prosecutor were Krishna. Krishna was everywhere for him. He didn't say that what he knew. Krishna was inside. That he's very polite and modest about. Because the Krishna awoke in him, he could see and relate to and enjoy the divine all around him. This is the purpose, to enjoy not only the unity, but to enjoy the diversity of the play. But that's not all. The individual can also enter into the transcendent and know not only that the divine is in us, not only that there's a divine being in us, but that we are the transcendent. We are the Ishwara. We are the God that has created the universe. the consciousness, the transcendent, infinite existence beyond the universe. It's not that we can just go visit them. It's not that we can just have that experience. We can know that that's the truth of our being. Well, it's getting a little confusing. I thought I knew who I was. I give up the ego. Now you tell me I'm a soul inside. Then he tells us that we are one with souls in everybody else. Then he tells us that we are one with the transcendent, and that's our real self. Well, can't we make up our mind? Who is our real self? Do we have three selves? And here's where mind and logic get in the way, because he tells us the individual, the universal, and the transcendent are not three different things. Our problem is because we think with the mind, which divides everything up. See, either I'm here, or I'm there, or I'm there. I can't be all three at once. I can't be three things at once. Then there's not one divine, there are three divines. You talk about oneness. All the three are expressions of the one. The ultimate reality, the problem in the tradition is that the tradition has approached the divine through the mind. And the only thing the mind can do is divide. Whatever you do, it divides. So when it discovers the divine, it divides it from the universe. When it discovers the Purusha, it divides it from the Prakriti. When it discovers Brahman, it divides it from Maya. When it discovers the one, it divides it from the many. When it discovers there's an infinite, it divides it from the finite. And the whole central message of this book is there is nothing divided. There is one that expresses itself in many different ways. The infinite and the finite are not two opposite things. The finite is the frontal appearance of the infinite. The inside of the box and the outside of the box are not two different things. You can't have an outside of a box without an inside, I think. You can't have an inside without an outside. No. Which comes first? Which is divine? Which is more important? Every box has an inside and an outside. The inside of this box is infinite and the outside is finite, or you can put it the other way and say the finite is the inside and the infinite is the outside. The one and the many are not two different things. It is the one that expresses itself as the many. The infinite and the finite are not two different things. It is the infinite that is expressing itself in an infinite variety of finites. We don't have to give up one to know the other. What we have to do is give up the ignorance. The yogi who goes from the finite to the infinite, he gives up one ignorance for another. He gives up the ignorance of the false world to go to the ignorance of being in the undifferentiated oneness, thinking the rest is not real. The truth is that the inside and the outside of the same box. We and the spirit, the supramental realization and the yoga he's talking about is that we should know, we should be the one and enjoy the many as the expressions of the one. We should know we are the infinite, but be able to discover the infinite in every finite thing and every finite event and every finite moment, because they're two sides of the same reality. So the main theme of this chapter is the individual, the universal, the world around us, and the transcendent are not three different things at all. There are three aspects of one thing which we call the Absolute or the Brahman. We experience them separately now, but the goal of the evolution is life will become divine when we experience them as one. When we are able to know at each moment You are the transcendent. You are universal. And you are a unique individual expression of the divine. You are all three simultaneously. And when you have that knowledge, you can discover that truth in everything and everybody around you. And every moment becomes a divine moment. Everything that happens, every word that's spoken, if you speak any words, every action becomes an expression of that infinite oneness expressing itself in the manifestation. He goes further. He says, what does it mean to say that the individual and the universal and the transcendent are one? At some level, they are one. He goes further and says, the individual, the whole world is there in each of us. He calls it mutual inclusiveness. The whole world is there in each of us. The whole of Indian society is there in each of you. The whole of it means it's represented by you. If you go deeper down, say the whole of human nature is there in each of us. Some of us prefer to express some of the 27 characteristics and others prefer the other 27, but they're all there in us. The whole world of human nature is there in each of us, but we each put up a different variety. But you remember in the story when Lizzie and Jane meet Lydia and Kitty at the inn, and Lydia tells the news that Mary King has given up Wickham. And Lydia says, that freckle-faced, ugly girl. And Lizzie makes a face. She feels offended by, embarrassed that Lydia should speak that way. And Lydia says to her, don't look at me that way, Lizzie. I know you think the same way. Lizzie would never speak it out because a very mean thing to say. But yes, inside she has the same thing. So in that sense, today we can say the whole of human nature is in each of us. In a truer sense, all our lives are what have come from the world around us. The opposite is also true. We are there. The world is in us. We are in everything in the world. We are not separate. We are intermixed. When Lizzie's at Pemberley, and she thinks, just think, I could be mistress of Pemberley. And 5 minutes later, Darcy walks by. How does it happen? If Lizzie and Darcy are really separate from one another, if the outer world is really separate from the inner world, how does her thought or feeling bring Darcy? Because to the mind, it looks like they are separate. If she and Darcy are really unconnected with each other, how can anything she says or thinks or feels affect him? There's no connection. There is a connection. There's a direct connection. Long before they're married or anything like that. Because each of us is in the other. Each of us is related to everything around us. That's why life responds to us. Life responds to everything we are inside. Rather, to put it more, everything that comes to us from outside is a reflection of this. This is our world. This is the world we have created. And though we may live in the same place, the world is different for each of us. The world relates to each of us differently because it's a relationship between something in us and something around us. He says the whole secret of the divine existence, the perfected, the divine life is to discover our mutuality and relationship with everything around us based on our essential oneness with everything. We will know that all is the divine, but we will also be able to relate harmoniously with everything around us. Inwardly, we are one. Outwardly, we are harmonious. That is the purpose, the whole secret, destiny, and purpose. And the more we know ourselves, we will discover it's not just a spark or a speck or a little bit of gold ore that's buried in there. He says the whole transcendent is in each of us. If you remember in a much earlier chapter, he says, the whole of Brahman is there in every small act. Not a little bit of Brahman. It's not that Brahman has distributed itself. The whole infinite is there in everything. The whole infinite transcendent is there in each of us. It's not there physically in each of us. It's not a physical thing. It's our truth of our being. The spiritual substance of our being. What does it mean to say that the whole infinite is in each of us? If you turn it around, it means we can be anything we want to be. Right now, we mostly feel there are certain things in me, there are certain things in you, there are certain things in you. We each have our qualities, good strengths and weaknesses, and all I can do is try to bring out my good ones and leave away my bad ones. But the truth is, the infinite's there. That's why he says, that's why the Gita says, you can become anything you want to become. Because potentially you are everything. It's for you to decide. It's for you to choose. Darcy chooses. I don't want to be this anymore. I want to be that. He does it. That's the choice for us. Even if all of this is convincing, there's still one fundamental obstacle for divine life, which maybe you haven't thought of yet, but he has thought of it for us. So that's okay. Still, when you look at it in its entirety, the world is relative. The world is always changing. We know that the real truth is in the absolute. So sooner or later, the divine has to, we have to go back to the absolute, isn't it? This is all temporary. After all, the world was created at a particular time. Before that, there was only the absolute. So divine life can't be eternal and immortal because the world itself came into being at some point in time, and at some point it's going to go away. And the Indian tradition talks about seven creations at all. So immortal life in a physical body is a dream because the real truth of existence is only in the absolute. This is what the tradition says. Whether the relative is an illusion, as Shankara said, whether it's a nightmare, as Buddha said, or whether it's simply temporary, it's not where you can place yourself for eternity, is what all the traditions say. Fulfillment has to be somewhere else. He says even this is a mistake of the mind. Even this is only a confusion where the mind thinks that the relative and the absolute are two different things. The idea that the relative was born on a particular day in the Jewish and Christian Bible, God worked for 6 days and created the world, and then he took a rest on Sunday. Isaac Newton, who was such a famous genius of a scientist, he spent half of his time trying to calculate the actual day on which the earth was created and the world was created, and he figured it was about 6,000 years ago. This is what a genius could do at that time. But all the traditions are like that. Sri Aurobindo says no. The relative itself is eternal. The relative is not something that's been created by the absolute. The relative is the expression of the absolute. The relative is the outside of the container. The absolute is the inside of the container. Stop dividing reality, because there's only one. The world has always been eternal. Maybe this planet or that planet or this universe, may have existed or not. Maybe the scientists are right about a Big Bang or not, but they're definitely not right about the cosmos. Cosmos is eternal. As long as the divine has been there, he has not only an inside, he has an outside. The outside is he's expressing himself. The inside is his being. The being and his becoming. The becoming itself is eternal. And the destiny of the becoming, which is the world for us, which is life for us, is to express outwardly what he is inwardly. And because he's infinite inwardly, he needs a long time, an infinitely long time, to express that outwardly. Because there's so much to express, it's unlimited. And therefore, the relative is going to go on and on. The thing that's going to change is not whether there's a cosmos or not, but whether the cosmos is a cosmos in ignorance, whether it's a cosmos in involution, or is it a cosmos of evolution in the knowledge, whether the beings in the cosmos are conscious of what they are, or they're unconscious of what they are the way we are today, and think we're all separate and mortal and finite. So in this chapter, he challenges the deepest fundamental flaw in all the spiritual traditions of trying to say, however you add it up, no matter what your tricks of language, and you say man is divine and this and that, at the end of the day, this is all secondary, that's the real reality. As if this is something else. If that's the real reality, what is this? Well, Shankara came up with a very clever explanation. He said, you see a rope on the road, but you mistake it for a snake. You're seeing Brahman, but you're mistaking it for world. Sri Aurobindo says he was the greatest intellect that ever lived. But that doesn't make him right. Then the question comes, if I am mistaking the rope for a snake, who is it that is mistaking it? And what makes it look like a snake instead of a rope? If Brahman is the only reality, Brahman must be seeing the rope as a snake. There can't be two. There can't be somebody else who's making it look like a snake or confusing the issue, because there's only Brahman. So the world is real. The world is divine. It's not showing its divinity now. It may look like a snake now, but it is the absolute. It is the Brahman that is not in the illusion of a snake. It's manifesting only that now. And what we want to do is, we want to see not that it's a rope, but we want to see that it's the divine. We want to see that everything in it is divine. So one of the errors of mentality is that we think the absolute has been forever and ever, infinite and eternal, but the world is got a secondary status. He said no. The world is also the divine. It's the omnipresent reality. It includes both what is manifest and what is unmanifest. And therefore, You see that no vision ever on earth has ever really recognized what the destiny is. That this is the best possible. You can't imagine something better than this. Everything we are today has the potential of becoming and will become divine in the future. We are in that process of self-discovery. Yes, this can. I think that's what I tried to address first. The first step is we have to discover the psychic in us. Psychic is our first goal. How do we discover the psychic? He says we have to universalize. How do we universalize? We have to cease experiencing ourselves as the separate ego. How do we do that? We have to first reject not one or two, but all the movements of the ego and move from the ego towards the psychic by following all the road signs that we were talking about earlier. Values, all the spiritual values, goodness, self-giving, non-initiative, silence, harmony, all the values, the cheerfulness, unflagging cheerfulness, all of the positive values that are divine in their essence, that take us away from the human ego and its separateness towards the oneness. That's the first step. Quite a handful. It means we have opportunities at every moment, right? The moment I say, I think I'll do things, the moment I want, who wants? Can we even for a moment get out of it? And what do you think? What do you want? If we start doing that, every minute is a challenge, no? Every moment is an opportunity. So he says, this idea, one of the notions of the absolute is that it's a complete emptiness. There's nothing inside. And all the qualities of the universe are somehow undivine. But he says, the absolute is not an empty zero. It's a zero packed with infinite potential. With everything in it infinitely in potential. A silent mind is not a stupid mind. Only when the mind falls silent, we can begin to know more. Sri Aurobindo delivered his famous Uttapara speech. It was a very flaming, inspiring speech. He did it from a complete silence. There was no, he was in nirvana. He was completely silent on the surface. He wasn't speaking at all. The voice of the divine spoke through him and inspired everybody. Only when we silence ourselves, what we mean by that is the ego, our confused thoughts, our jumbled feelings, our confused impulses, only then something truer can express. So the silence is not an emptiness. The silence is the condition for something truer to express in us. One disciple came to Pandi and Sri Aurobindo gave him silence just when he talked to him. And after a few days, the man wrote to Sri Aurobindo and says, I feel like I'm going mad. Because there's no thought. He's given him a high spiritual realization. He prefers the noise and confusion of the ignorance. Of course, we won't be like that, right? Yes. 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 Sorry? Right. Right. Excellent. Excellent. The observation was that the differentiated unity may be sound good when we're here. It may make sense. But when we go outside, we only feel the differences and the conflicts. We don't feel the unity. Excellent point. Because every conflict is pointing us towards a unity. It'll be clear with Wickham and Darcy. Wickham and Darcy and with Lizzie in the middle. It's all conflict. But that conflict is pointing towards a unity. Wickham misses the point of the conflict. He keeps going in the wrong direction. Whatever happens to Wickham, he always, the next thing he does is more stupid and foolish than the last thing he did. First, he was offered a living. He refuses it. Then he takes £3,000 from Darcy to become a lawyer. He squanders it. Within a year or two, he squanders a huge amount of money. Then he starts borrowing and going in debt. Then he comes to Meryton and starts spreading scandals against Darcy. Then he goes and elopes with Lydia. Each step he takes is more foolish than the last. It's no wonder he ended up where he was. But what about Darcy? First, he made a stupid mistake and called her tolerable and lived to regret it. He made another stupid mistake by proposing to her in such a rude and crude manner. But when he came face to face with that conflict, he recognized there's a truth in it. Let me learn from it. And he moved towards unity. So the truth is, every conflict that comes to us, every sense of difference that comes to us is pointing us towards a unity, meaning it's pointing us away from our ego. A few weeks ago, a man in the World Academy where I'm working sent a very rude letter that that our administrative office has not properly dealt with some of the new fellows without asking for any of the facts. It was a thoughtless letter for people who are working very hard, and I was offended by it. How can they? They don't know anything. They're not doing anything, but they want to criticize somebody else. And I felt very self-righteous. You see, these people are doing nothing and they're criticizing. In fact, the man who criticized was the man who we asked to take responsibility for this work, and he said he didn't do it, wouldn't do it. But now he wants to poke holes and find fault with somebody. And after a while, I asked myself, why is this happening? Why is this coming? It's not coming for me to defend myself or my staff or to feel self-justified and to feel and to abuse that man. It's coming because there's a progress that I can make and we can make. So let us sit down and figure out how we can do it better and become more perfect. When I justify myself, the disharmony increases. I energize him. He becomes more self-righteous. He accuses me more. When I discover there's a truth in the falsehood of his accusation, I move towards unity. I move towards mutuality. And then I can thank him if I want at the end. I said, if it wasn't for your rude criticism, we wouldn't have been better. We found a better way to do it. And that's the truth. We have discovered many things we can do better because of it. So our whole lives are like that. Wherever the world comes into conflict with us, wherever it rubs us the wrong way, which it does just about all the time in one way or another, it's again a signpost for us. Turn around and go in the other direction. Find a way to not win the war or win the conflict. Find a way to convert it into unity. That doesn't mean we have to go out and shake hands with our enemy. It means we should discover the enemy inside. We should discover the scandal inside that has evoked the scandal from the other man. That's what Darcy did. He didn't go back and apologize to Wickham. He had nothing to apologize for. He didn't even thank Wickham for scandalizing him. But he made the progress he should make from hearing what Wickham said. Our whole life is an opportunity then. You've just described an infinite opportunity. No? Very good point. Okay. So our first confusion is that, like everything else, we think the absolute and the relative are somehow different from one another, and we have to be in one or the other, and one is good and one is bad, and one is better or one is worse. What we want to do is we want to express the absolute in the relative, not go from the relative to the absolute. He said there's a second error that we have, and he calls it the law of contradictions. Whenever we think, we tend to think in terms of opposites. This is good and that's bad. This is right and that's wrong. Again, the story of Wickham's scandal comes in so handy. Because if you have to say, is Wickham right or is he wrong? Is he a good man or a bad man? No, he's definitely a bad man. He's a scoundrel. Is his scandal good or bad? No, it's definitely bad. But you say a bad man having a bad scandal leads to another man becoming better. If the other man becomes better, then there must be something good in the scandal. Rather, there must be something true in the scandal. How can something false make somebody else better? Only the truth in the falsehood can make somebody else better. Then it's all confusing. Now I don't know whether he's good or bad, or scandal is good or right or wrong, or anything. Because it is confusing, because life is not this or that. Life doesn't fit the law of contradictions, which is the way our mind tends to think about things. This is got a truth. The opposite also has a truth in it. The key for us is not to find out who's right or wrong, as we always want to do, and find the other person's wrong and we're right. The key is to find the truth in the other person even when they're wrong, and find the wrong in us even when we're right. Because it's not one or the other. There is always a truth. Sherbindo says, the greatest, most violent accusation that can come to us, most ridiculous, absurd attack that can come to us, always has a grain of truth in it. Why? Everything has a grain of truth in it. This makes marriage very difficult. No? If you have to recognize that your partner always has a truth in him, of course, you'll remind him that that's also true from your side. But that is the I'm sorry you aren't at the mic, because I don't think the rest of the other meeting could hear. Can you repeat it? Because I can't repeat it so nicely.
Because we are seeing everything as a contradiction. When contradiction comes, but we react and we are seeing the opposites only. But when but it makes us quiet and energetic and calm. And when we are doing this exercise as self-discovery, this is very, very enjoyable. Because we can do this exercise every second these exercises are going on. Because we are facing the same thing. Now, always not contradiction, but is this easy? And we are thinking, is this good or this bad? But if contradiction comes, that has a very good force, and that gives us that much of energy. But we become quiet and calm and cheerful, and that energy also accomplishes. That's the thing I realized. Because this is very good exercise. We have the work is work for us is that. That really I'm enjoying this exercise. It is not a yoga, we have to sit there and but we have to mingle with everybody. We have to be with them and we have to enjoy with them quarreling and contradiction. But this is very nice experience that gives us most energy, but realization also comes. And that is very cheerful, very, very cheerful. But it takes time. Sometime it comes, we are realizing very easier. Sometime we have to go inside and concentrate, and we have to see the other man's point of view, and we have to see our side. And when it meets together, we can feel that one. Inside. That is the reality. That gives, but gender gives that very much good opportunity for us. Everybody, what she is asking is, because our classes are giving that much of experiences, we have to think. But immediately we are quarreling and we get angry. Everything is going on. As a human nature, we are doing. But immediately the chance of changing into that area became one. That gives most energy.
So, if we go back to our signposts, it turns out every conflict is a signpost. It tells us we're going in the wrong direction, turn around. Every moment is such a signpost. So, as Nehru Maharaj said, it's yoga. It's converting life into yoga. It's making everything that happens to us in life. It's not that we have to run to hide and meditate in order to make a progress. It's every place and every moment when life is jarring on us is an opportunity for progress. The most important progress is what? Where do I need to get? I need to get away from my ego. Now I feel I need to get away from that person who's abusing or quarreling or pushing or dominating. The one thing I need to run away from is not anybody out there. I need to run away from my own ego. And everybody's there to help me do it. Everybody's there to remind me that my ego is wrong and I should give it up. So I should be thankful to everybody who's helping me go in the right direction. We have to learn how, the trick. It's a trick. Everybody can help us run away from the ego, but we would prefer to run away from everybody else. That's true. So if there's a truth in everything, and it's opposite in everything, now you understand the genius of Davin when he wrote the stories of Inspector Sambu. An idiot genius. A man who's really an idiot, but he's got genius in him. The author had that perception that even in idiocy, there can be genius. And the opposite is equally true. If you see the greatest genius, he'll be an idiot in other respects. It's a profound spiritual knowledge. Sri Aurobindo uses the analogy of the diamond and the pearl to help us understand this phenomenon. A diamond is different, a pearl is different, none of us will confuse them, especially when we're shopping and we have to fix the price. We know they're different. They are completely individual and separate and distinct from one another. But at another level, diamond and the pearl have a common origin. Both the diamond and the pearl are made out of what was once living material. Neither diamond nor pearl can exist on a planet where there was no living life. Pearl comes from the oyster. Diamond comes from previous earth organic material, carbon material from plants and animals that has been compressed and over millions of years and converted into diamond. So at another level, if you look at the diamond and the pearl, The chemists will tell us they're both organic compounds made of long chains of carbon. They're common with one another. If you know the commonality between the diamond and the pearl, you have the power to create diamonds and pearls. And they do it today. They make what we call the synthetic diamonds and artificial pearls. Because they know the commonality to what us looks like something totally different. We never mistake one for the other. Because they know the commonality, they can convert, they can create a diamond, they can create a pearl. But at a deeper level, they're not just common. At a deepest level, they are one. The physicist will tell you the energy, the substance of a diamond and a pearl is all energy, and it's the same energy. The electrons in the diamond, the electrons in the pearl are the same. So essentially, they are one. Sri Aurobindo says, if you have knowledge at the level of the essential unity of everything, you can convert the pearl into a diamond or the diamond into a pearl. You can transform. So the power of transformation comes when we know the essential unity. So we have an individuality where we're each different. We have a commonality where we each share the wonderful characteristics of human nature and other things. We have an essentiality where we're one. When we reach that essentiality, we can transform ourselves from anything into anything else. We can transform the ignorant, false, selfish, human life into the divine life, the mortal life into the immortal life, by knowing that oneness. So that's why the essence of this is we must discover that unity in us, that essentiality. That's the self in us. That's the divine in us. We must discover our commonality with everybody else. That's the divine in everyone else. And we must know the individuality of each of us and respect it. It's not like we're all going to look the same or think the same or behave the same in a divine life. We'll all be distinct individuals, but we will know our commonality, our mutuality, and we will also know our oneness. And that's the formula for the divine life. When we know that, we can become whatever we want to become. And this life in the ignorance will become divine life. And we'll be manifesting the divine in our individuality, and we'll be discovering the divine in the whole world around us, where we're now discovering conflicts and competitions, because that is the basis. So now you see, whenever we think we're right in a quarrel, we are lost in the law of contradictions, in which we assume somebody must be right and somebody wrong. The moment you remind yourself that the law of contradictions itself is wrong, and that there's a truth in everything and a truth always in the other side, we take a first step away from the ignorance. So our job is not to come to terms with one other person, but to harmonize ourselves with everybody around us. And we cannot do that just by adjusting with other people. We cannot do that just by giving up the selfishness of the ego that will help us make a start. We can only do it when we discover the divine in ourselves and the divine in others. That is the basis for our unity and our mutuality. The problem is when we look at others, we discover only mistakes. Yes. But Exactly. That much transformation means we have to stop defending the ego. The ego finds everybody else is wrong and it's right. Then we know. The moment we think somebody else is wrong, immediately we can understand we're in the ego, which means we're wrong. Whatever they are or not, we have to be wrong. That's the knowledge. Yes. What you may not know what is common, but you definitely know what's uncommon. You definitely know where you feel different. Wherever you feel the conflict of difference, you can know that you are in your ego. Wherever people think differently than we think they're wrong. Whether they're wrong or not, we are wrong. We need not worry about them. We need not worry about making them think the way we are thinking. We are emphasizing our difference means we're emphasizing our ego. If we really understand Sri Aurobindo, we will know that nobody's wrong. Right now we think we know the truth and nobody else knows the truth, so we are right and they're wrong. That's because we've not understood Sri Aurobindo. Nobody is wrong. Everybody's right from their point of view. We are right only when we know everybody's point of view. The truth is to know everybody's point of view. Sri Aurobindo never wanted to go around and try to convert anybody or convince anybody of anything. We can liberate ourselves from ignorance. We want to liberate everybody else from ignorance, which will only make us more and more ignorant. By seeing, that's Darcy, isn't it? Darcy goes everywhere. He goes to Meriden and sees everybody's wrong here. Every savage can dance. He doesn't realize there's only one savage in the room at that time. It's Darcy who's behaving like a savage by condemning everybody else out of his superior culture and breeding. That's the truth. That's why Sri Aurobindo's so polite. Sri Aurobindo tells us that the one became the many. The one became the many not by ceasing to be one. At no time has the one stopped being one. You need not feel sorry for the divine that it has lost its divinity. In becoming the universe, it never lost anything. The infinite in becoming finite has not ceased to be infinite. The one in becoming many has not ceased to be one. The divine in becoming us remains divine in us, in the world, and where it is. The only thing is we don't know it. It knows it. The problem is not for the divine consciousness, the problem for us to know that we are the divine. When the one manifested as many through an involution, it created the superconscient and the inconscient. It created spirit and matter. Spirit was a state in which the divine knows itself only as the one. Matter is a state in which it doesn't know itself at all, but it's only the many. That's how the manifestation begins. The one takes two opposite poises, one as spirit and one as matter, and they look to be so different from one another that the scientist says there's no spirit and the yogi says that the world is an illusion because they have nothing to do with each other and we're caught in the middle because we're part one, part the other. And we don't know that this and that are the one in different form. And this The universe is the spirit and the matter coming together, the spirit awakening in the matter awakening to the truth that it is spirit, so that life, which is a product of spirit and matter, will become divine and know itself as an expression of the divine. That is, in a sentence or two, his vision of the whole involution and the evolution. And that evolution, that involution was from the knowledge of the oneness to the ignorance of thinking that matter is one thing and spirit is another thing, and then never the two can meet one another. And we are in the process of coming out of that involution. We are evolving out of that involution from ignorance to knowledge. We are in the ignorance because we think that God is separate, world is separate, and we are separate. That's definitely qualifies us as ignorant. We think we're separate from everybody else. We're really in the ignorance. But we are on the evolution out of the ignorance where we can discover our oneness with the world and our oneness with God. He says that the human being is the highest power of the individual on earth in life divine. I think Mother says in the universe somewhere. But in life divine, he says we're the highest power on earth of the divine emerging. Our destiny, the destiny of the human being, of the individual, is to reunite spirit and matter, to reunite the divine being with nature. The psychic is the meeting point where the superconscious descending and the subconscious evolving meet and know their oneness, where the individual and the world and the transcendent meet and discover their oneness, that there are not three at all. There is one that's been expressing as three and has three different poises, but is really one. And the human being, that's us. We are at the point where we have the power to transform. We can transform the ignorance into the knowledge. We can convert the involution and separateness into the evolution of mutuality and oneness. We do it in every moment by the choices we make, in every situation by the responses we make. We do it every time we step back from the ego. Every time we call Mother, every time we consecrate, every time we move from the sign ways to falsehood, to the sign ways, to the signals to truth, every time we move from a lower value to a higher value. And what's going on? Each of us is a divine story in which the divine is awakening. The divine is awakening in each of us the way it awoke as the lover in Darcy. Each of us is a story, a divine story on a way to a divine life, in which what will emerge out of that is not that I will be more important than I am today, that I will be, and each of us will be more divine than we are today, which means we know the importance of everyone else and we enjoy the divinity in everyone else. The divine is unfolding in each of us is the secret of the universe and the secret of the manifestation. We are at the turning point. It's never been there before because we are the first species on earth that's conscious. The whale and the lion and the dog and the cat and the fish and the bird cannot do this. They're being carried up by nature. We're at the point where we can make choices, where we can decide, at each moment, do I want to move towards the divinity or do I want to move and the truth or do I want to move to the falsehood? Do I want to do what Wickham did and keep taking steps downward to see what it's like to roll down the hill? Or do I want to take like Darcy and take steps forward to discover more of the truth of life and my existence? And Appa's theme is, we have the power to abridge Darcy's 1 year into the 6 days of Gomri's level. We have the power to abridge the progress of a lifetime or 100 lifetimes into 1 lifetime or into each year. We have that power of transformation because the divine is awake in us to the point where we can know what's true or not. We can know what's ego. At least we can know what's false, even if we can't know what's true, and we can say, I don't want that. I want something truer than that. We can reverse the way Darcy reversed, the way Lizzie reversed in her way, the way Mr. Bennett reversed in her way. So when Appa said 10, 15 years ago, every devotee should have a car, every devotee should have a house, and when he said a few years later, every devotee should have 100 crores, he's not speaking out of wishful thinking. You already have that 100 crores inside you. You already have that. That is your essential value. As a mother's devotee, it's already there. It's the gold nugget in the clay ball. All you need to do is not try to make more clay, but try to get the gold nugget and bring it to the surface. You don't have to do anything. That money will come because it's there inside. It can't be given to you if it's not already there inside. So we are the individual trying to awaken. We're trying to wake up out of the involution and the ignorance and the falsehood of thinking that we're separate, to know the truth of ourselves. And we do that, first of all, by rejecting our identification with all that is small and petty and separate and selfish and mean, and do the opposite. We try to awaken through selflessness and self-giving. We grow by self-giving. The family is our first training ground because it's the first place where we have to come into contact with other people and adjust with other people and hopefully live for other people more than ourselves. But most of us, if we even do that, and many people even in the family are very selfish. Lydia doesn't think about the family at all. She didn't even live in a family. At least Lizzie has made family life. She's so much concerned with the good of Jane that she doesn't think of herself. In that measure, she's made family the training ground for her growth. That's only the first training ground. We have the whole world as our training ground. The whole world is our school. Our work is our school. Everybody we meet is our school. Everything is our opportunity to make this progress. But many people, we stop at the family and say, no, no, the only people I care about, the only place where I need to be good or selfless or is in my family life, that's to stop at the first grade and refuse to go on and discover our further destiny. In fact, as we said, every moment is that opportunity to shift and reverse ourselves from what I want and I need to what others want and need. From my pride, prestige, and self-importance to what's important or of value to others. From my getting my rewards and just desserts to recognizing what everybody else does and feeling grateful for what everybody else does and all that we receive from others and from the society and from mother. from an ingoing preoccupation with myself to an outgoing self-giving to others. It doesn't take time. It takes sincerity. That's the message of this chapter. Ashok, question? Please turn on your mic.
Do you hear me now?
Very clear.
You made a reference to the potential capacity for earning 100 crores by each devotee. Now, I brought your attention a newspaper item I read where a domestic maid was gifted 600 crores worth of property by a Congress politician. Appa says goodwill can bring prosperity. And as proof of that, he says it is Lucy's goodwill for Jane that pestered the Pemberley Castle. And it is Charlotte's goodwill for the Bennet sisters that brought her Longbourn. Now it's difficult for me to believe that the devoted service of a domestic maid can fetch 600 crores of worth of property. This is what I can't allow even in my wildest imagination for the capacity of goodwill to bring prosperity. This is too much. Unless some miracle is taking place. How is it possible that the devoted service of a domestic maid can fetch 600 crores worth of property which she can never earn even in 10 lives?
And you're not talking about a story. This is not some made up story. This was a true event published in the Hindu. So what you're unable
to event.
So what you're unable to believe is not a possibility. What you're unable to believe has already been a reality. That's why Appa talks only of 100 crores. He says actually it's not 100 crores, but 100 crores is the most people can even imagine in their distant imagination. And if I say it's more than 100 crores, they'll lose faith in me completely. It's not 100 crores, it's anything you want. What this story shows is the atmosphere is there. The grace is there. That's what Appa's been trying to say. After 1956, after the descent of Supermind, after Mother and Sri Aurobindo have come, that grace is there in the atmosphere. What this story shows is two people, we don't know the people, we only know the fact. We don't know what is the goodness or sincerity in that lady or the goodness in that man that was receptive to this level, to respond to Appa's thought, to respond to a supramental vibration of self-giving. We only know the fact that it's happened. The fact that it's happened, if it happens once, it shows it can happen. If it happens, it means it's possible for human nature to be like this. It's possible for life to be like this. It's possible to happen today in India, not in America or someplace else where I don't think it's happened. I have not heard of such a thing before. So what this is a confirmation that what Appa is saying, they're not devotees as far as we know. It's a confirmation. It's not just true in a story. It's not just true in theory. It's true in practice. It's for us to qualify for it by our sincerity. I'm very glad you mentioned the example. You told it a few days ago, and it's most appropriate. It's a confirmation of everything Appa's saying. Great.
Thanks.
Any other questions from anybody here? Yes? I won't understand the Tamil, but I want other people to hear it also. You cannot attain the 100 crores by being selfish. The 100 crores will come when you want everybody else to have it. It comes to you for your being unselfish in your heart. When you are unselfish in your heart, when you are self-giving in your heart, it will not just come to you, it will come to others also. And the more comes, it depends on who, you're not, it will come to others, it may come to others more than it comes to you. So what happens to Charlotte? Charlotte has goodwill for Lizzie. The result is she gets Longbourn. The result is Lizzie gets Pemberley. For the ego, the ego will say, I would rather have nothing than allow somebody else to get more than me. That's the old story, you know, of the man praying about his enemy. You know the story, no? If God comes and says, I will give you whatever you pray for, but I give your neighbor twice as much, he says, then I want to be blind in one eye. That's the ego. That's the ego. That's how Mrs. Bennett feels. She would rather not get anything than Lady Lucas get more than her. That's the ego. This is what will come to us through self-giving, through oneness with others. Charlotte wanting great things for Lizzie gets Longbourn. Lizzie wanting great things for Jane gets Pemberley. Your prosperity with this attitude will bring greater prosperity to others, because you're not doing it by isolating yourself from others and aggrandizing your ego. You're doing it by giving up your ego. In that measure, you're one with everybody else. One devotee doing this will help many devotees do it. That's like many devotees have seen. When you pray for everybody to get, everybody gets. And we get. When we pray, if I say, this actually happened once. We had a manager at our mother estates. He wanted rain. He was praying that rain should come only on Mother Estates. It actually happened. One day it rained just at the Mother Estates and nowhere else. Abba said, how selfish this is. And you got it for one day. If you pray that rain should come to all Tamil Nadu, you'll get rain every day and everywhere. The selfish prayer will be answered in the minimum. The selfless prayer will be answered in the maximum. We cannot get more without others getting more. Because the more we want is from being one with the society. Say, can I get more knowledge by praying that I alone should get knowledge? The knowledge is there in the world today. It's on the internet. The more I share my knowledge with others, the more we all get. Knowledge is not something to be hoarded anymore. The more we share it, the more we all get. The more we share our knowledge or our understanding, the more we all have at the end of the day. So we get, the formula is, the more we give, the more we get. The more we want others to get, the more we will receive. A very good point you've raised. Hope it's clear. Any other question or comment from any of the other centers? No other questions then. Okay.
இன்னைக்குள்ள டாபிக் வந்து நம்ம ரியலி ரொம்ப என்ஜாய் பண்ணினது என்ஜாய் பண்ணிட்டு இருக்கோம். இப்பதான் நம்மளுக்கு செய்யறதுக்கு இம்ப்ளிமெண்டேஷன் வர சமயத்துலதான் நமக்கு வந்து தொந்தரவா போயிடுறது. அதாவது நம்மளுக்கு தெரியும், விஷயம் தெரியும், ஆனா வந்து அந்த இம்ப்ளிமெண்டேஷன் தொடங்கறது தான் அந்த எக்ஸசைஸ் நம்ம தொடங்கணும். அந்த எக்ஸசைஸ் தான் நம்மளுக்கு டெய்லி ஒர்க்குங்கிறது அந்த எக்ஸசைஸ். அந்த எக்ஸசைஸ செய்து பாக்கறது தான் அதோட ஸ்வீட்னஸும் அதோட சந்தோஷமும் வி கேன் என்ஜாய். எல்லோருக்கும் அனைவருக்கும் நன்றி கூறி வணக்கம் கூறி மிஸ்டர் கேரி டேக்கர் சார் அவர்களுக்கு ஸ்பெஷலாக நன்றி கூறி விடைபெறுகிறோம். வணக்கம்.